Transmission will start in 5 seconds from now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, in.
Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper Podcast. This is episode 23 for June 2009. My name is Paul Davison and I run the website www.stormcock.net. In this show we will have a brief news update, an interview with Mr. Simon Taylor, the A to Z of Harper, this time it's the letter V, lots of music, listener feedback and a progress update on the competition. I don't actually have very much news this month, but I just wanted to give you a quick update on what's happening on the Stormcock website. I've done a couple of small changes to the forums in the last couple of weeks, which can be accessed via the forums link on stormcock.net. What I've done is a couple of things. I've put a chat box on there, which lets people talk in sort of semi-real time. So if you notice other people that are using the forums and you want to send them a quick message, you can. This only applies to people that have an account, so if you haven't yet registered on stormcock.net, this is your big chance. The other thing I've done is I've added an embed code to allow people to put YouTube videos in as forum postings. There's an instruction about how to do that in the site suggestions forum. If you go in there and have a look around, you'll see that there's some videos that people have put up there. Some of these are things that people have done themselves. In particular, Andy Watterson's put a couple of nice things on there. Some of them are music videos that people have put together to accompany tracks, and Sean is busy putting together things there. Sean had a bit of a problem with losing his YouTube account the other week, and he's busy recreating those. But it adds a certain extra dimension to interacting on the forum, so I'd encourage you to go and give it a go. Apart from that, that's all quiet on the Western Front, really, except to say that this is the end of May weekend, and in the UK we are enjoying a fabulous day. I'm recording this part on the Saturday, and we went out earlier, sun blazing down, went out on our bikes, wonderful day, long may it continue, basically. Knowing the English weather, that means it will continue for about 2 days, and then it will rain for the rest of the year, but I'm sort of keeping my fingers crossed, because it's lovely, really nice. Our first music track for this month is 12 Hours of Sunset, and I've chosen a live version from the audio CD of Beyond the Door.
Sweeping skies and breezy greens can maybe show us what it means to feel the world. Imagination. I'll come and see you yesterday. We'll close our eyes and drift away. Can we be real without escaping? Of sunset, 6,000 miles, illusions and movies. Far away smile. half a day in the sky. I'll be with you tomorrow. The steel crow flies. Oh, how time flies. I used to think I wasn't mad, but now I know it's all I had. Can hope be lost or only see me now the time has turned into space, and there's no time to check the pace, and no one cares. Can I be dreaming? Twelve hours of sunset. Twilight sublime. I'll be with you tomorrow. Backwards in time. Oh, how time flies.
I probably sound like a bit of a broken record to some of you, but the Beyond the Door DVD and audio CD is a fantastic product, and if you haven't got it, I'd really recommend you check it out. Now, on to our interview for this month. So, my guest this month is Mr. Simon Taylor, and I'll explain a bit more about who Simon is in a second, but hi there, Simon.
Evening.
Hello. Well, just
nice to be here.
Thank you. Well, just to set the scene slightly, Simon's up for the weekend. He's an old friend of mine, and we've already had a curry and three or four pints of my homebrew beer. So
very nice,
hopefully this will be a well-lubricated interview. And well, let's start off by saying how I know Simon. We met when I was 16, I think. We were we were at the same sixth form college, basically, over in Southeast Essex, doing A-levels. And I got to know Simon through another friend, actually, and the three of us became partners in crime, playing Dungeons and Dragons some evenings.
Mainly as an excuse to drink homebrew.
Consuming homebrewed beverages
quantities of
various description, and also discovering music as well. I think, actually, there was meant to be some coursework in there somewhere, but Simon and I were never in the same class, so we had a good excuse for not doing that.
Absolutely.
I was 16 then, and I'm ashamed to say I'm 44 now, so as you can probably tell, Simon and I have known each other for a very long time indeed.
28 years. There you go.
I can hardly believe it.
Only seems like yesterday.
It seems like...
The day before.
Pretty much. So let's talk a bit about music, first of all. And Simon, leading up to the Roy Harper stuff, first of all, how did you find that you were interested in music as a wee nipper? What were your first sort of musical voyages, if you like?
Oh dear. Not embarrassing, but actually my first ever single I bought, I'm quite proud of, was The Osmonds.
Which one?
1973, Going Home. I bought it on holiday in Wales with my family from a very rain-sodden holiday, as they all were.
Right.
My first ever single. And then I spoilt the run after that by buying things like Leo Sayer and the Smurf song and the Floral Dance by Terry Wogan and lots of rubbish.
Oh, God, my mum had
But
that.
When I moved on to albums, it was ABBA.
Right.
When I was about 13.
That's actually still quite okay, really.
Yeah, because as most people did, fancied Agnetha.
Which one was that? Was that
the blonde?
Oh, of course, yes.
And then moved on to Blondie, because everybody I knew fancied Debbie Harry.
I was going to say, I can detect a theme here.
And I think everyone I knew at school had Parallel Lines.
Yes, that actually, the album that is of the 70s. Brilliant album. I still listen to it every now and then.
And then a bit of ELO, Out of the Blue.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got into sort of things like Rainbow, Rush.
Yes.
And more serious music. And then Led Zeppelin through Duncan's brother and our role-playing games, sessions, and listening to that. And then sort of expanded a bit more at university after that.
Well, I remember very well the sort of music we used to listen to. And yes, it was a lot of Pink Floyd and Zepp and I think...
A bit of Van Halen occasionally.
A bit of Van Halen, yeah. I actually listened to some Rainbow last week. It's been so long since... And it seems actually really simple music now. But at the time, you know, I think during that period and also with the Rush and stuff, I think that was when I first got interested in more challenging music. And it seems a bit early in the interview to be talking about progressive music, because I always managed to talk about it sort of towards the end, but I'm going to start now and say that a lot of it was proggy stuff, and Rush was an excellent example of that.
Jethro Tull,
we'll talk more about your Jethro Tull enthusiasm in a bit as well. But challenging music, stuff with interesting lyrics but also complicated musical structure. And that's what's always kept me interested in music. I like, you know, your classic 3 or 4 minute pop song, but it doesn't have any sort of lasting worth. It's a thing that you enjoy at the time, and it doesn't sort of make you think too much afterwards.
Absolutely.
Oh gosh, we used to listen to Yes as well, didn't we?
God, yeah, I even bought Tales from Topographic Oceans when I was at university.
Have you ever listened to it?
I listened to it once. I must revisit it. It was quite painful at the time, but Yes, but I love Yes now.
Yeah. Yes,
especially
indeed.
Heart of the Sunrise, brilliant track.
Right.
And Bill Bruford's time with them, absolutely amazing.
Well, Bill Bruford, of course, classic drummer, and his work with King Crimson, who we didn't discover in those days, but
not
I have since become an avid listener.
And a little bit with Genesis as well, brilliant with Genesis.
Yeah.
Him and Collins together, amazing.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm a definite fan of the earlier Genesis rather than later Genesis, but Phil Collins is a good drummer, no matter what he's doing, and you know he fits it to the genre that he's trying to do. Now, of course, during those formative years, we also dabbled with musical instruments, and you, Duncan, and I had band of sorts. It wasn't really, it was more an excuse to just make a racket every now and then, which we called Driftwood, and Duncan used to play, I suppose, rhythm guitar and
write songs,
yeah.
Lyrics and chord structures,
yeah, and I was farting around on a bass guitar
and I was whittling about playing lead.
Whittling
trying
about
to play lead.
And before Simon got here, I actually found an MP3 of the only known remaining recording of the three of us playing a song. And I'm toying with the idea of putting it on the end of the podcast. If you're listening to this, then if you wish to donate to the podcast, I'll possibly not include it. But it's too late now, of course, because it's downloaded to your computer. Anyway, let's get on to Roy Harper. Now, my memory of that was that we started listening to Roy Harper in their last few months of being A-level students, but you remember slightly differently and you think it came the following year.
I do.
But anyway, whichever it was, as I recall, the early albums that we started to listen to was Work of Heart, which had just come out on the original...
82, wasn't it?
82, yeah. And then there was Unknown Soldier, which I think was still in the shops.
Mm-hmm. And all on vinyl, of course.
After that, it got a bit confusing, but I know that you managed to find Flat Baroque and Berserk, and I know that you found Flashes from the Archives of Oblivion. Did you not?
I did. I actually managed to find all of the early stuff on vinyl, even Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith.
Mm.
And Valentine, eventually, with a proper fold-out cover.
Oh, that's right.
On Harvest, not on the reissue.
Because they're all terribly
rare. It took me
a
long time to go around record fairs, and I think even in 1984, I bought Flashes from the Archives of Oblivion at a record fair, and it cost me about £25.
Yeah, which was quite a bit of cash at the time.
I've played it a few times to record it, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's still in fairly good nick.
Mm. So, I mean, sometime after that, of course, they started to get reissued, because I remember when I was at university, the Awareness stuff started up, and I could start buying it. And I remember they reissued Folk Joe Coppers quite early on.
Yep.
And in fact, I've got a mispressing of that. It's got Magoon's Blues on both sides. such a great track,
brilliant,
obviously.
Brilliant.
I needed to hear it twice, but missed out most of the other tracks.
Mm. I actually managed to get a booklet for Valentine through Awareness that didn't come with the record I got from the record fair, to sort of make it complete.
Oh, right.
You could, on the record, you could send off for it.
Yeah, originally. There was an address to write to in London or something, wasn't there?
I think I might have even tried that and got no reply, 20 years after it was real, 10-15 years after it was reissued.
Some little old lady got a letter and thought, well, there's another of these strange young men. So, obviously, we all liked what we heard, but I can remember that being the first one was Work of Heart, it didn't really grab me that much initially. And in fact, I'd still say that out of all the albums, that's probably the one that I liked the least. Mm. I mean, what was your...
Well, because it was all with the band, wasn't it, as well? So it was not didn't lend itself immediately to learning the bits on guitar
and things.
That's true.
But also, it had this kind of very polished 80s type feel to it.
Yeah.
Which I don't think has aged very well at all. I mean, what was it about Roy's stuff that you liked?
I liked the simplicity of some of the earlier songs. I think, I mean, I would say probably my favourite album to listen to is probably Stormcock.
Good man, same here.
Because, I mean, the songs are all kind of fairly lengthy, kind of, not quite, I mean, prog's the wrong word to use for it, but they're extended musical pieces.
Mate.
Yeah, extended musical pieces with lots of...
Or prog.
Lots of, intertwining structures, as they say. But the songs are just really good. You know, they're very sort of extensive pieces. There's lots of really, quite meaningful lyrics as well. You have to really listen to them to get the full meaning of the song. And and they're just, the harmonies, the melodies are just great. I just really like it. And it lends itself to sort of learning them as well, because it's, an acoustic guitar or an acoustic guitar with a bit of lead playing along when Jimmy's on there.
Mm.
And they're just really nice songs to try and learn, and it just grabs you.
So that's treating it from a musician's point of view, and that is interesting, because I've said quite a lot before that I think, if anything, Roy is a musician's musician in a way. He's quite a hard casual listen, and I think that people that aren't so interested in what's going on musically find it a little bit harder to find the hook. But the other thing he does, of course, is write these amazingly poignant songs, either about love situations or...
Do you mean poignant?
I mean poignant, because that's how I choose to pronounce it.
Sorry, okay.
Or political stuff or, social awareness stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think he, out of all the people that... I still think to this day, out of all the musicians that I've heard, he still has the best and most pithy approach to that. Mm. And he says a lot of stuff that I don't think I've heard other people try and say. And that's why he's possibly never been that popular with certain parts of the establishment.
Mm.
And I know...
To his credit.
Yeah, completely. Mm. And during those early university years when, you know, we were all probably a bit more idealistic than we are now. I still am idealistic, I think, but...
Well, I think I am as well.
Yeah, right? I think you probably are.
You can't lose your principles.
Well, you can.
Well, people shouldn't.
But one of the great things about Roy's stuff is I can listen to the albums and immediately it transports me back to certain times and events and places and feelings about what the songs are about. And it's a way of maintaining some kind of connection with principles that, you know, having a busy life and lots of distractions, sometimes you lose sight of the most important things.
I mean, he's certainly a man that's never lost his principles.
No.
And you can see that in his songwriting, can't you?
I think so. So, obviously, you have seen him live a bit.
A bit, yeah. First time was actually Cambridge Folk Festival in 1984.
With Jimmy Page.
When Jimmy and the band did an afternoon set on the Saturday, I think.
Right.
And he played the Friday night and did a fairly short set and did play McGoohan's Blues, which was amazing. I actually bootlegged it with a really rubbish tape recorder.
I've got a recording of that, actually. Not from you. And that's pretty ropey as well, before everybody gets excited.
And he did a set with Jimmy,
yeah,
where they did some stuff off Jugular that had just come out, where he played, there was just Roy and Jimmy with electric guitar. And they also did a full sort of afternoon set with the full band.
That was Tony Franklin on bass.
Oh, yeah. Who went on to play with Jimmy in the Firm.
Yeah. Who was drumming?
Frellis Bass, yeah.
Who was drumming? Can't remember now.
Not sure.
But Nick Harper wasn't playing with him at that time,
no,
was he?
Not at all.
Well, I suppose he wouldn't have done with Jimmy there anyway. So that was a pretty good experience.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I managed to hang around backstage and get both their autographs, which was quite nice.
Which you've still got, actually.
Which I've still got somewhere, yeah. And Jimmy was just concerned with his... Could you hear me properly?
Right.
Because he did have some problems with his sound in the first couple of numbers, but it was great. What can you say if Jimmy Page asked you what his playing was like? He's like, yeah, you were brilliant.
Well, yeah.
What else are you going to say? Actually, I thought you were a bit rubbish.
Because they also played at the Rock Garden in London, didn't they?
That's right, yeah.
Either before or after. Sadly, I didn't get to see any of those. And I don't know why. I didn't actually start going to festivals until later. So you were earlier than me there. But I don't know why I didn't go and see them in London. Maybe I was just not, you know.
I don't think I went to see them again, though, for about sort of 3 or 4 years after
that. Right. And then what that was, then it was, because you ended up down in Sussex.
Yeah, went to uni in Brighton and stayed basically and still there now. Great place to live.
It is a nice place. So you saw him locally a few times, and of course...
He played at the university a couple of times, yeah.
We have a mutual friend in Dave Burnham, which long-time listeners will know, because he's been been interviewed. And yeah. Dave was promoting gigs for a while. And I think both of us went to some of his promoted gigs.
He did some amazing gigs with Roy. I mean, sold out every time.
Yeah.
So.
And.
Very well done.
During that phase, at some point, of course, Nick Harper also started to plough his own furrow.
That one's brow.
And yes, thank you. And he started off with accompanying Roy and doing sort of, you know, lead stuff with Roy and eventually started doing his own stuff as well. Have you seen Nick play solo?
I think I have. Yeah. Well, I've certainly seen him play solo supporting Roy.
Okay.
But not necessarily in a gig on his own.
Right.
I was just thinking, we were talking about the gig in Hounslow earlier on.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first time I saw Nick played like a very short support set for Roy then. And he played a little bit with him as well.
Oh, okay.
But he only did like about 3 songs beforehand, and he was very sort of sheepish and
he was very nervous and
but very good though.
Shaky in the early days. And now, of course, you can't get him off the stage. But but I mean, he has got such an enormous talent.
Absolutely.
That I'd say he was, you know, as far as technical ability on the guitar goes, I think he's better than his dad. He's got a different approach to songwriting, but he's also. If you haven't, you should listen to some of his solo albums, because it's got the same kind of feel to it. It's got the same issues and the same approaches in a way, but it's
the same energy as well.
It's got a lot. The energy's there, and it's got a slightly more modern take on things as well, in some ways. Guitar playing, then, going back to the guitar side of it, what is it about the guitar that made you want to pick it up?
God, there's a question. Well, thinking back to the days of the early days of Driftwood, as you do, you know, chatting in the sixth form common room, let's form a band, what are we going to do? I want to be the singer. No, I want to be the singer. No, I want to be the guitarist. And I think we had a few discussions amongst us.
Right.
You know, Duncan wanted to play guitar. I thought, oh, I'll be a singer. No, actually, I can't sing very well, so I'll be a guitarist.
And, yeah.
I don't know. I kind of started playing it because my mum had an acoustic guitar that she was going to play and never did. I learned a few chords and I just kind of got on with it.
It was a horrible nylon jobby, was it?
Horrible, yeah. Fairly cheap. It wasn't quite from Argos, but it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Really wide neck, very difficult to play.
Right.
But just learned a few chords and things. And then thought, right, I'll get an electric and bought a fairly cheap electric from a local music shop, which I subsequently lost at university.
Music?
No, it wasn't actually. It was Tim Gentle Music.
Okay.
That's in Leon C. That's now an accountant or something horrible.
Yeah.
I know, what a shame. And Honky Tonk Music shut as well.
Oh, well.
I just bought an electric and just got on with it, I suppose. I just liked what you could do with it and I didn't find it that difficult and found it a lot nicer to play than the, you know, clarinet and recorder that I played when I was younger.
Well, because I had piano lessons when I was younger, but I stopped doing that, I think, at grade 3 or 4, I can't remember. I didn't get too far with it, but I knew how to read music. But at that point, the six-string guitar wasn't really my thing, and I ended up playing bass. I don't remember really how I ended up playing bass. I think it was just, you know, made an impressive noise, and I liked it.
And you ripped the frets out.
We did after a while, yeah. It
sounded really good.
Bought a really cheap bass, which is right behind where you're sitting, actually. I still have it. Yeah, it's right there. And it still doesn't have any frets.
It's not even a K. It's not as good as a K.
I thought it was K.
Or maybe it is a K.
Oh, well, whatever
make... Catalogue bass.
Whatever make it was. It was about the cheapest one they had in the music shop. But that was fantastic. And for a long time, I was playing that through a sort of home... made amplifier or whatever, I can't remember exactly.
Well, if people listen to the MP3 of Driftwood, you'll hear exactly what it sounds like.
And you'll also hear what an impatient player I was because everything was going too slowly, so I kept trying to speed things up. But of course, we never had a drummer, which was a shame, but that's where things get serious with bands because that requires a whole different sort of setup in terms of where you can actually practice and how
and
you go about
time.
It. Yeah, completely. But the thing I've always found very impressive about your guitar hobby, Simon, is that you never gave up on it. And you are now playing in some bands. So why don't you tell us about what you do now?
Okay. I'm actually involved in 3 current projects at the moment. I'm in a Jethro Tull tribute band,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of probably the highest profile of the things I'm in.
And that's the Dayglo Pirates.
That's called the Dayglo Pirates, yeah. Yep. And we've played at conventions in Spain, Italy, Germany. We've had kind of fairly good reviews from the Jethro Tull fanzine.
Mm-hmm.
And from Ian Anderson himself, actually.
So
kind of jokingly said, oh, you know, what are you doing on a Wednesday and a Friday? Maybe you could, you know, take some of the load off me if you give me your 10%. So, we really enjoy doing it and we try and make it as authentic as possible.
Yes.
Very challenging to do, obviously.
Well, Tull's music, again, is proggy, it's complicated. Some of their pieces are incredibly complicated.
We tend towards the more proggy, complicated things rather than the more 80s keyboard-oriented,
yes.
kind of less interesting things.
Yes.
So it's mainly from the sort of 1968 to 1980 classic period.
That's good to hear.
Amazing to do.
Mm.
Really good fun to be involved in.
What are the other bands?
The other bands, I'm in a kind of a pub rock 4-piece called Tortoisehead.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a theme coming, don't worry. Which does kind of comedy, not comedy rock, sorry, proper rock.
Yeah.
But in a kind of very fun way, lots of kind of segues of songs into each other.
Right.
And things from other genres done in a rock style, like ABBA, Lionel Richie.
Oh, okay.
That kind of thing. Which is brilliant fun to do. We've just changed singers recently because our singer left the band.
Bizarre gardening accident?
It wasn't a bizarre gardening accident. It was a bizarre footballing accident.
Oh, no.
Yeah, broke his ankle playing football and can't kind of stand up.
Oh,
but I'm still involved with him in another band, which I'll come on to in a minute.
Yeah.
But we've just found this new Spanish guy who's a really good kind of rock singer. He's got a really good rock voice, so we're just doing our first gig with him in a few weeks.
Oh, cool.
Actually, next Friday.
Oh.
Not a few weeks at all.
And where is
lots
that?
Of intensive rehearsals. Where is the gig? It's at a pub called The Six Bells in Chiddingly in East Sussex.
Right.
On the 29th.
Oh, actually, this will be out after that anyway. I don't know why I'm trying to plug it. This is out 2 days after that gig.
Thanks for trying, anyway.
Damn it.
And my third project is a two-piece with the ex-singer from the other band,
yep.
And we call ourselves the Brown Stripes. It's a two-piece. I play guitar and do backing vocals, and the other guy plays drums and sings. So it's a little bit like the format of the White Stripes.
Okay.
We said we're like the White Stripes, but we're shit.
I'm glad you spelled
that out.
So we don't
actually think we are.
Won't have got the joke. Right, good.
I hope the listeners are, your readers are intelligent enough to know that kind of thing. But no, that's kind of what we'd call comedy rock.
Right.
So it's lots of things with a brown theme, because it's the Brown Stripes. So we do songs like Skids in America by Kim Wilde,
God.
That kind of thing. And we always wear fancy dress when we play.
Yeah, I've seen some of the photos.
Yes, so that's great fun.
So what on earth has possessed you to have three separate projects on the go?
Just because they're all good fun, and I don't like to sort of turn down an opportunity. And they're all very different in the approach. The stuff I do with the Brown Stripes is a lot more rhythm guitar. Concentrating on, you know, actually, because it's only guitar is the only melodic instrument apart from the voices.
Oh, I see. So you can't really go on to Flights of Fancy with
No, occasionally, stuff. But, you know, I've got a couple of other things that help me out. Like there's a theremin in the background that I kind of reach over and play occasionally. And I've toyed with the idea of using bass pedals, but I've not actually practiced with those yet.
I think that's quite difficult.
I've bought some, but
right.
I've not really practiced with them yet.
Obviously, when you're the Martin Barr, is it Barr or Barry?
I think it depends on which way the wind blows and what Ian Anderson's had to drink the night before.
Okay,
so I tend to call him Martin Barr, but he does call him Martin Lancelot Barre.
He does, yes.
When he's feeling very sort of flouncy and Elizabethan.
Okay.
But Martin Barr, I love his playing.
When you're the Martin Barr, obviously you're doing the... I mean, he actually is... I've always thought he was an underrated guitarist, and I think, you know, he's been in that band since God knows when.
Second album.
Been a solid player all that time, and...
He's actually really good as well. I mean, I'd like to think that what I try and do is a reasonably close approximation to what he does, but you know, a lot of things I have to kind of cheat and, you know, not quite do things in the way he does them, because he just he's such a good player. And
have you ever
some
met
of
him?
The never no
okay.
I'd like to
mm.
It'd be nice to see what he thought of what we're trying to do as
because we've
had some feedback from Ian,
yes,
you know, with a kind of grudging recommendation to acknowledgement, I suppose, anyway.
It must be a weird thing, actually, having tribute bands around. I mean, you know...
Especially when you're still playing.
Exactly. For things like Doors tribute bands, I fully understand why they're... You know, that's great.
Yeah,
nobody's
Pink Floyd,
got the
Led Zeppelin, yeah.
It must be a bit odd feeling that there's young people on your coattails, almost. That's one of the cat flap. That's not the first time that's happened, either.
I can't believe there are actually... There's like an Antarctic Monkeys... and No Oasis, who are an Oasis tribute.
Yeah,
band.
But the thing is, you know, people haven't got any hope of seeing the real thing. Certainly not in a small club.
No, that's true.
And not for, I don't know, however much you charge, a tenner or whatever.
Less.
Well, I was going to say, actually, presumably all these things are hobbies for you.
Completely.
Cost money rather than generate money.
Certainly. Well, the Dagger Pirates is reasonable, because we've got to the stage now where we get a reasonable guarantee. And it depends on the promoter as to how much they charge people, but it's not normally more than £10.
Okay.
In some places, if it's a small place, it might be £5.
Mm.
The other two bands, we get paid by the pubs, and people get to watch us for free.
Oh, I see.
So that's just, you know, it covers expenses.
Yeah, classic pub band.
With the duo, it's we spend more money on the fancy dress costumes than we get back from being paid by the pubs. So I've got three wardrobes full of fancy dress, which is fine.
Now, to me, I've only ever had one experience of playing before an audience, and it was at the Stormcock subscribers' party the night before Roy played at the Royal Festival Hall for his 60th birthday. And some listeners here I know were there that night, and we took over a bar in Covent Garden, and we had an area set up for people to play, and it turned into a folk club situation. And some people were fantastic, including Pavlov's Cat, and people like
that's a good name.
People like Andy Roberts, and some people were shit, like me. And I can still remember, you know, I sat there, and even though everyone in the room I knew either personally or through the internet and knew I was in a supportive atmosphere, I was sweating buckets. It was really difficult. So how on earth did you feel when you first started doing it, and has it got easier?
It's got a hell of a lot easier. The first time I did it, I felt really nervous.
Right.
Cause the first, I mean, I'd you know, done a few little things with other people, but
yeah.
These sort of main three bands that have kind of been fairly serious, and I've been involved in two of them for probably 10 or 11 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And the duo's been going for about 4 years. It was, yeah, I think that it was the Jethro Tull band I did the first gig with. And it was because it was nerve-wracking because the music was complicated.
Yeah.
And we'd rehearsed loads. We'd been rehearsing for about a year before we felt we could even vaguely do the songs justice.
Yeah.
And we weren't doing complicated songs to start with. We were doing fairly, well, for Jethro Tull, fairly straightforward songs. And you know, it's only recently we've brought in things like Thick as a Brick and Songs from the Wood. And we're even attempting Heavy Horses at the moment. But
have you tried any Passion Play?
No.
I rediscovered that album the other week. I bought the reissue.
That's great.
And I think it's quite underrated.
Well, when we played a convention in Italy, and one of the Italian bands was made up of just sort of scratch musicians who were all proper, you know, classically trained. They could read music, unlike what we can't. And well, actually, no, that's unfair. I can't. Our keyboard player's brilliant,
right?
That kind of thing. But this band, they just had sheet music in front of them, and they did the whole of a Passion Play from sheet music.
Wow.
And it sounded amazing. So, you know, there are quite a lot of Italian Tull tributes around.
Well, actually,
they let themselves down on the vocals.
Italians have a affinity with complex music. Van de Graaff Generator, which is another of my enthusiasms that most of the listeners are probably groaning about now, because I mention them every podcast as well. Van de Graaff Generator had a huge following in Italy, and I think it sounds really cliched, but I think it's the operatic influence. I think it's the very expressive, you know, very emotional nature of the opera that's kind of part in their musical blood, if you like. And so some of the music that's come out of the classic prog era has a strikes a chord with them.
I mean, I don't know if you or the readers will have heard of, well, no, but because I'd only heard of them recently. But there's a really good sort of 70s Italian prog band called PFM.
I haven't.
It stands for something Italian, the PFM, but I don't know what they are because my Italian is non-existent.
Okay.
But anyway, but they are very good and very prog, very old school prog.
So yeah, going back to the live playing, you were very nervous at first.
Very nervous to start with, but it gets a lot easier once you, as long as you're, you know, you rehearse a lot, you know, you've got the kind of band chemistry with people,
right?
And you do get used to playing in front of an audience fairly quickly.
Do you think it's easier in a band than it would be on your own?
Much,
because
you can dilute yourself.
I think so as well.
But I mean, we played to this Italian convention, and there were about 400 people there in an 18th century opera house.
Right.
And it was quite daunting, a big stage, you know, there was even a monitor mix separate monitor mix on stage, as well as being in front of house mix, which I never ever had before.
Right.
You know, two different sound engineers looking after the band. Brilliant.
Did you have a guitar tech to pick you up off the ground when you fell backwards?
No. That would have been nice. I ought to change my strings for a minute, probably.
Oh, well, yeah.
But that actually was fine, because we'd been together for sort of, but at that stage, probably about 7 or 8 years, you get used to it. I think if I had to play Glastonbury or somewhere on the main stage, I would probably still be really nervous. But it does get a hell of a lot easier.
It sounds a little bit analogous to what I found when I used to do a lot of training and teaching. And the first couple I did, I was shaking like a leaf. And then after that, I still felt very nervous for like the 5 minutes before I actually started. And then as soon as I got stuck in, you just fall back into your routine, and it's all, you know.
Exactly. It is very similar to, like, well, being a teacher myself.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it is like that, because when you first do it, you know, bricking yourself before you teach your first lesson. And then by the time you've done it a while, it's just like, right, sit down, shut up, get your books out. don't you dare swear at me again, etc.
So the question that everybody will be asking themselves, and they'll thank me for asking you this, is are there Jethro Tull tribute band groupies?
Unfortunately, well, actually, I was going to say unfortunately not. There are, but they're all in their 40s, male, with beards, and drink real ale.
That sounds like and me.
I have lengthy conversations about what type of valves are they in Marshall.
Oh, no.
So in terms of, you know, the classic kind of, you know, groupies backstage, no.
That's very disappointing. No.
But there are lots of regular followers that come to lots of our gigs.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's even a Dagglo Pirates Appreciation Society.
Is there really?
Brackets Dartford branch. It's two people.
Really? I didn't know that.
And they're brilliant. They come to loads of gigs. John and Steve, they're brilliant. They come to gigs. They sort of they do kind of weird things, dress up strangely, or bring sort of strange effigies and things. And they're brilliant. They enliven the audience. It's great.
So you haven't got an internet site set up by a fan, and you haven't got people podcasting about you yet?
No, we're not in the same kind of realms as, for instance, Roy Harper.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
No, obviously we have our own websites, which I won't shamelessly plug.
No, you will. In fact, we'll put some plugs in the show notes rather than reading URLs out.
Absolutely.
On the interview, because that's just silly, although I seem to manage to do it quite a lot and then realise what a mistake I'm making as I'm reading them out. Last month in particular, with Arrow from Finland, had this very long Finnish URL with all sorts of tildes and slashes and squiggles. So yeah. I don't think we'll do that, but no. we will put links in because I think people will be interested in it. Can I ask technical questions about you mentioned about having monitor mixes and so on? I mean, I haven't played an amplified gig. I don't know quite how it's set up, although I have helped Tony Pugh to set up for a gig. In fact, I helped him with the sound at an incredible string band gig one year at the Bloomsbury Theatre. He needed some help, and it was cash in hand, and I got to lug some boxes around and drape cables from the front of the hall round to the back, and met Robin Williamson, who was absolutely charming, and it was great. But I didn't have much of a clue about what was happening technically. Obviously, I have a reasonable technical knowledge with the podcast, although you wouldn't think that if you'd seen how it took me half an hour to get things working with the microphones today. But how does it work? I mean, how do you stop feedback? How do you get the signal through? How does it all fit together? If that's not a silly question?
Well, I mean, I'm not the best person to ask, because normally people that are performers don't really have much to do with that. But I do actually do the sound myself for the Brown Stripes, for the duo that I'm in.
Oh, okay.
Because we're kind of self-contained of our own little PA. I've just kind of put a new one together, which is fairly straightforward to do, actually. But the it's actually relatively simple. You have a mixing desk that gives the takes the signals from all your microphones, puts it through to the main front of house amplifier, which goes through your big speakers that the audience hear, and you can adjust things like the high, mid, and low EQ on each channel individually. And then you can take a feed off of that channel and feed it to a separate amplifier, which goes to the monitors. And I guess in the old days, I've never really done this, it's a bit of an arcane art, but you can cancel out feedback by using graphic equalizers to reduce certain frequencies that resonate in the room.
Oh, using notch filters or whatever.
Yeah, but nowadays, and I've just got one of these, really quite cheap actually, you just get a feedback destroyer, and it intelligently senses when a frequency is feeding back and then puts its own notch filter in for you.
And
you can see it through a gig. Gradually there's more and more lights light up, and you haven't even heard any feedback. It's
how
just
interesting.
Sense that something's going wrong.
Yeah.
And it does it set you it's got two channels, so I've only got two monitor mixes. So you just put each monitor through one
how,
side.
How
of
does
it.
That deal with would I be right in saying you can get feedback from the main amplification speakers, but also from
you can
whatever
so you've
got on the
you
stage.
Can have a separate one that's going that you feed the main signal in through, but basically you hardly ever get any feedback from the front of house because it's
facing
in front
away.
Of all the microphones.
Yeah,
so it's mainly on the monitor mix. If you had four monitors in the mix, you'd have to have two of these feedback destroyers.
Oh, okay.
Because you can only do two separate channels on each one. It works great. I've only used it once so far, but it had loads of lights lit up at the end of the gig,
no,
so it must have done its job.
I like my gadgets. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, I mean, it was only £100.
Well, that's a bargain.
Yeah. So, I mean, I put the whole PA system together for about £600.
Right.
So
and I suppose for the pub stuff, is
it's,
that...
It's fine. It's quite loud for
yeah,
pubs.
Yeah.
It would do a fairly big room and it would be comfortable.
Right. With guitar effects, one assumes you use like reverbs or choruses or whatever.
Yeah, I actually use different setups for the different bands, actually.
Right. Now, that comes... That's in line directly before it reaches any mixer or amplification, is it?
Yeah, you do. You have signal out of the guitar, goes through effects first, and then through the amplification afterwards, yeah.
Okay.
So I've got a kind of a fairly extensive rack effects that I use in the both of the sort of proper bands, you know, with like 4 or 5 piece bands, because it's simple to, because they've all got songs that need radically different setups for each song.
Right.
So, you know, the Jethro Tull might need a clean sound on one song, it might need a phaser on another one.
Right.
Harmonizer on another one. So to do all that with stomp boxes would be really difficult. You'd be fiddling right. around for half an hour between each song,
yeah,
setting all the different things. So you just press one button and go to the next thing.
And is that run by a computer then, or is that some special?
It's just got digital, digital processing chips inside it. So you just got, there's a pedal board on the floor, and you pre-program it all before the gig, and you just select patches, and it just does.
Oh,
I mean, a lot of them are very similar. They'll all be the same distortion setting, the same echo or whatever, and then you just put a phaser on the end of it or a harmonizer on the end of it.
Part of the reason I'm asking that is because I've been watching what Nick Harper's been doing, and he seems to run all of his effects from his Mac through Logic Pro, and it seems to have I'm only using Logic Express for the podcast, and Logic Pro is like 4 times the price.
It's but got it, lots of plugins that you can plug, lots of different modules you
exactly
can get.
And it's got USB driven control devices, and he's got foot pedals that turn effects on and off, and he has settings that he loads per song that he's singing, but it's all based on the laptop. And I think, well, that's, you know, that's fantastic. It's amazing what you can do with just one computer doing all the digital signal processing. But it's also a single point of failure, isn't it? I mean, if his laptop goes kaput, then he's got a bit of a problem.
Mm.
I mean, equipment does fail.
It does, that's true. Yeah. Now, a lot of people actually don't have sound modules and things anymore because all the voices and stuff are all done via the Mac.
Mm.
And there are lots of really good sort of drum sequencers and all sorts of things. But, you know, if you've got Logic Pro, a guy that I've recorded some stuff with has got, Logic Pro, and you can have like piano modules and everything. It's just fantastic.
Hmm. The next topic, I suppose, is what ambitions do you have for your music, if any, or are you happy with the way things are?
I don't want them to be careers.
Right.
I think I'm at the... Well, I mean, if I was offered, you know, would you like to join the real Jethro Tull and whatever, then obviously I wouldn't say no, but I don't think that's obviously not likely to happen. But if... It's fun doing things as a hobby, and I think if it was... if there's the pressure of doing it as a job all the time, it would probably lose its fun.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Although, you know, if the opportunity came up, then, you know, I think you'd be a mug to say no, but I quite enjoy doing things as a hobby and meeting lots of really good people through it and, you know, not having the pressure of having to, you know, record your own music. And whatever.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
It's a bit of a cop-out, copying other people's music, but, I mean, the Jethro Tull one literally is a straight copy of what they do, because that's the whole nature of being a tribute
band. What people want to hear.
Both of the other bands are putting some creativity into it, but not writing the songs, but radically changing them and putting your own stamp on things.
Have you tried writing your own stuff?
Not really, no. I've not had the time, to be honest. One track I think I recorded with Tortoise Head, that's it.
Okay.
But it takes a lot of time to record things anyway, but to write them as well. If I wasn't working, then maybe.
Well, that's the thing. Music is a hobby for most people, and I think you're either very lucky or extremely talented or both to actually make a career out of it.
Mm.
But this leads on to something I didn't put on your crypt sheet, Simon, so apologies for this. But I ask everybody that comes on the podcast about where they think the music industry is going in terms of, is downloading killing off the music industry? Is it still something people can make money from? Or do you think it's just basically retreating into, you know, your people sitting in their bedrooms with their laptops making incredible stuff anyway, and does it need to still be a commercial endeavour?
I think a lot of people do download, And I, you know, have to hold my hands up and say, I'll do it myself.
Oh, I freely admit that I do as well.
But a lot of people use it as a way to sort of sample something new, and then they'll then they'll think, oh, that's really good, I'll go out and buy the CD. Because even though we don't get, you know, gatefold 12-inch vinyl anymore, there's still a lot to be said for having the proper artwork and the and the lyrics and whatever and stuff about the band. And it's not the same as a proper 12-inch album where you can get proper artwork. You know, a little tiny CD booklet isn't the same, but it's still something. And it's still going to be better quality than downloaded music. If you,
I that's exactly what I keep saying. And you can see in this room, I've still got tons of CDs and I still listen to them because it sounds a lot better than stuff through iTunes to my ears. But a lot of people don't care.
No, a lot of people don't care. That's true. But I still think a lot of people do still go out and buy CDs. And actually, you know, from being a teacher, it does come up sometimes. And quite a lot of kids, actually, you know, teenagers will actually say, oh, no, you don't want to download. You know, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, there are two schools of thought.
Yeah.
And some will just download all the time and say, oh, I don't care, it's cheaper, or because it's free. But, you know, a lot of people still buy CDs. And, you know, and obviously live music is still very popular.
Oh, completely. But I suppose the other question is there still the environment such that a young group calling themselves Jethro Tull still has the ability to make it and actually become well known? Or is that infrastructure not there now? What do you think?
I think bands are still coming through all the time, so I don't see... I mean, it may be via different routes.
Uh-huh.
To previously, but I still think a lot of bands make their success on their live performances, I think.
Which is the way it should be. And I remember you and I as young men complaining bitterly about people that couldn't actually play their instruments and just were created in a studio. You know, and when push came to shove.
What, in the 80s?
Yeah. Exactly. On top of the Pops, you know, miming. Where's the music in that?
I know. And you still get it with R&B now.
Well, yeah.
Worse, probably.
That's another of my bugbears, actually. Why call it R&B? Because it isn't R&B at all.
No, I know.
It's a load of rubbish.
Soul music. Urban street.
Yeah, that's right.
Gangstar. Oh, I can't stand it.
No, not, well, I'm afraid it doesn't do
it. It hasn't got guitars in it, I don't like it.
All right, so talking of what you do like, you said, in a very professional link to the next topic, what do you think an average discerning Royal Nick Harper enthusiast might like to listen to that perhaps they haven't heard of?
Well, the obvious sort of, you know, the obvious thing that people might like that's similar, I mean, but I guess probably most people who are Roy fans would probably be familiar with his music, but someone like Nick Drake.
Oh, well, I love
Nick.
Because
of the similarity,
Drake.
And I'm sure that's nothing new to most people.
Yeah.
If you concentrate more on the kind of extended musicality of a lot of it, and going back to our conversations about prog earlier on, you know, I still listen to Rush all the time in the car. I just, you know, they're just, especially their, you know, 70s work.
I still listen to 2112 quite a lot. When I've had a bad day working and my head's just not been working right, put a quick blast of that on.
Temples of Syrinx.
Yeah, brilliant.
But no, I'd say Hemispheres is for me the best album because it's just so prog. Every single song is in an odd time signature. there's nothing in a sort of straight four at all.
Yeah.
And I just love the playing on the album. The bass sound is amazing. The drums are just really technical. Guitar is brilliant. Alex Lifeson, I'm a favourite guitarist. So, you know, I'd say if you're not into Rush, then listen to their stuff from the 70s. Particularly Hemispheres.
That's
anything
good
up
bit
to Signals, basically.
Yes. Oh, Signals is great.
Signals
as well.
Is fantastic. Yeah. It's slightly keyboard influence, but
that's true. Yes, it did veer towards that.
But it got a lot worse later on.
And of course, their best track of all is "I Think I'm Going Bald." Okay, maybe not.
Do you?
No, yeah. Actually, it's thinning a bit, but, you know,
I think I've got a head start.
Ah, well.
I'd also, I mean, I one a band that I really like at the moment is Riverside.
Oh, yes, you mentioned them earlier. Yeah.
But they're Polish sort of prog metal. Lots of instrumentals, lots of really odd time signatures.
Pretty polished.
Very polished, though, yeah. Very kind of well-produced sound.
Right.
You know, keyboard. The guitar is like, you know, infinite echo, but very, very well done.
Oh, okay.
And it's, yeah, you might think it sounds a bit cliched in some ways and a bit formulaic, but it's just really clever.
I think it's very unusual in music to get anything that's completely new and fresh, because everything is derivative.
Mm.
You know, and you have this kind of musical knowledge that gets passed down. Yeah. I find that very interesting its own. I mean, a lot of people say that Dylan paved the way for the singer-songwriter acoustic-y stuff, but I don't think he did. I think he was...
I just wish he stuck to songwriting rather than singing.
He joined the club. I know, I can't... No, I've never got on with it. And I feel like I'm missing out.
Great performed by other people.
Yeah.
Hendrix, especially. Yeah,
completely.
But, yeah. Not by himself.
But again, I feel like I'm missing out there, but it just doesn't do it for me. Jeff Buckley, on the other hand.
Yeah.
I don't know if you he would be somebody I'd say every Harper fan should listen to. Yeah. But again, they're probably all...
Neil Young as well.
Yeah, actually, that's true. He's a bit of a rebel as well, isn't he?
Although, you know, he's very... In some of his earlier stuff, like Harvest and that, very similar in terms of protest sort of songs.
That's true.
That. But... when he does his electric stuff, especially with Crazy Horse.
Oh, it gets
amazing.
Gets
how
wild.
He controls his guitar sound.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
It just sounds like it's about to scream on him all the time. And he's an amazing player. Really good.
I was in the HMV Megastore, not the HMV Megastore, that was Virgin. The HMV store anyway in Oxford Street, buying, just browsing for music. And it was one of his tracks off of one of the albums in the 90s, Why Do I Keep Fucking Up? And that was a live version.
Mm.
And they had, obviously, whoever was playing the music in the store really liked him anyway. And they turned it right up. And I was stood there, you know, going through the CD racks. And I thought, what? This is absolutely amazing. And it went on for like 10 minutes or so with a complete feedback-ridden guitar explosion. And it, of course, they said who it was. And that was when I first started buying his stuff. And it was just amazing.
Mm.
Mm. Anybody else?
What that I like, or that I think Harper fans would like.
Let's say what you like.
there's nothing like what we've just talked about. But the I suppose it is a little bit. The bass player in Diaglo Pirates just introduced me to a band called Opeth.
Okay.
Like a kind of a Scandinavian death metal band, not death metal. Sorry, more like kind of goth metal.
Does it have more blondes in it?
I don't actually know what they look like. There is a female singer.
Okay.
But. I don't know. It could be a complete minger. I don't know. But they're very good. There's a lot of, again, lots of kind of extended musical passages.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of kind of shouty singing, which I don't like.
I've got some sort of crossover proggy metal stuff, and I still like some of the proggy Metallica stuff. But when it comes down to it, I don't quite gel with the metal side of things as much as you do, I think.
Yeah, well, I don't like the stuff where you can't... I sound like my granddad now. Well, you can't hear what they're singing.
Okay,
but when it's all kind of like, you know, demon voices or whatever. That,
yes,
that I don't get with. But if it's proper metal singing, like, you know, like Iron Maiden or whatever, that's fine. But that's more kind
Opeth.
Of
Opeth. Okay.
Yeah, but I've only got the one album that I heard. But they're okay, and I love Muse as well.
Oh, I like Muse. Yeah, was it Black Holes and? Oh, what's the name of the album?
Revelations.
Yes, yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, so they're an amazing band as well. Very good live DVD that they did recently.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, Live at Wembley.
Hmm, okay.
And a bit annoying to watch because it kind of flashes from one image to the next about every half a second.
Oh, right.
And you can't see what's going on.
Okay.
But sound like my granddad again.
I'm not, generally speaking, a big music video fan, but I got David Gilmour live in Gdansk the other month.
Was that for the anniversary of the formation of Solidarity, was it?
Yes, it was.
Oh,
and that's great. And they have a sort of 22-minute echoes on there.
Wow.
And I might show it to you later on, actually. That is fantastic, and it's real, you know, goosebump. That's one of my metrics for music, is if it starts bringing my arms out in goosebumps, then I know that something's going on, you know, and that really, really did it for me. But brilliant. David Gilmour isn't particularly cutting edge these days, but...
Still a great guitar player, though.
Yeah, very much so. He's not aged very well, though.
He's not very good at talking to people, either.
I don't know, is he?
No, he's a bit withdrawn, a little bit Asperger's.
Well, that's, yeah.
No, he's a great guitarist. I love him. Brilliant.
Okay, well, I think we've covered pretty much everything. But is there anything that you would like to say to the collected masses listening, Simon? No
put me
pressure.
On the spot. No pressure, not particularly. Just, I hope you've enjoyed listening, you know, to somebody you've never heard of before. Unless you're Dave and Sue. Or Paul. But just, I'd just, it'd be nice to see Roy playing a bit more live again.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I know that he's having a break. And I know that he's working on new material.
Excellent.
And has been in the studio starting to prepare stuff. Doesn't mean we're going to get anything in any particular time frame, of course. And, you know, understandably, in the early 70s, people used to bring out like 2 albums a year, and it's just not like that for him anymore. And I'm sure that if and when he finally gets to the stage of bringing something out, we'll all be there and very supportive of it and absolutely enjoying it. Yep. But I'd love to see him play live again, because I really miss seeing him play. Yeah. But, you know, time will tell, I suppose.
Here's hoping.
Yeah. Okay, well, Simon, thank you very much for putting up with the interview when you thought you were just coming here for a nice, calm, relaxing weekend.
Well, the beer's been very good, anyway.
Oh, well, so that's
I must apologise for the iPhone. Though you did get an Apple plug in there, right? You could have just said phone.
That's true, yes. Okay, Simon Taylor, thanks very much.
Thank you. Signing off.
A telephone wakes me in the morning to get up to answer the call. So I think I'll go back to the family where no one can ring me at all. Living this life has its problems. I think that I'll give it a break.
Hello, Louis All Saints Centre. Right, okay. I'm sorry, sir, they're all sold out, Mr. Anderson. I'm afraid you'll have to wait till next year, sorry. Bye for now. Sorry.
Everything I do is wrong. What the hell was I thinking? Phone keeps ringing all day long. Thinking every day is is the same old way of giving me too much to do.
Brilliant. That was, of course, the Dayglow Pirates with their version of Back to the Family. Before that was the interview with Simon Taylor. Thanks so much, Simon, for doing that. I think we both had a lot of fun on that one. Very good indeed. Okay, now I asked Simon what Roy Harper track he might want me to play on the podcast, and he said Same Old Rock, which, of course, is one of Roy's finest numbers. And I've kind of steered away from playing tracks from Stormcock on the podcast up to now, and I've tended to go for live versions instead, but I thought in honour of the occasion I'd actually play the original album version. Well, in fact, this is from the remastered version of Stormcock that came out last year, so this is the Same Old Rock.
Colors in a shade. Inside each eye is sitting like the sword inside the blade. Longs for once upon a chance to open love's cascade. Well, here we stand, hand to hand, fighting for the promised land. And you try to tell me with consternation that you have found me a brand new lock. And you try to warn me that there's only one combination. One new sling, the same old rock. There is a famous struggler stood on the edge of time, held the staff but did not feel the pain. He multiplied the mystery with utterance sublime, and crossed his heart for those who died insane. His friend, a restless mouthpiece, 7,000 years of age, trance to flash a face to shape his ways. Everlasting light is burning bright inside his cage. He's only got to breathe to find. Such a groove to have him here on board her ladyship, the man who makes his living out of bed. Such a gas to see him flying through his ceaseless lip. One day, someday, soon he'd lose his head. And with the ring in the galleries, with eyes fixed on the door, who and you and me, and thanks a lot. And those who see but cannot stand to walk on any floor, for fear that good is something bad is not. But loud and clear is the call in black and white across your wall. And damn it all, man, can't you see?
melody with consternation that you have found me a brand new love. And you tried to warn me that there's only one combination. One new snake, the same old
track still does it for me every time. Wonderful. Now it's time for the A to Z of Harper. It's the letter V, and I've chosen an album title which is Valentine. Valentine came out in 1974, and it followed Life Mask, which was potentially Roy's last album because he was very ill at the time, and he poured his whole soul into the Lord's Prayer. And in contrast to that, Valentine was an album of smaller songs, and I think it was described at the time as his kind of Sunday best. It's got some very poignant love songs on it, still some contentious stuff as well though. But it's a very good kind of microcosm of the acoustic, mainly acoustic, 1970s Roy, and it's got some songs on there that are very dear to me and that he still plays a lot live, in particular things like Commune and North Country. So, Valentine, what track to play from it? Well, I kind of cheated and I have already played 12 Hours of Sunset. The studio version of that, of course, came from Valentine, but I played a live version of it before. And I've decided to play Forever, which is a bit confusing in a way because Forever was first recorded on Roy's first album, but he revisited the song on Valentine. And of course, this is the updated version.
We're just spinning leaves in the flight of a dawn, little girl. Falling through an eternal horizon of time. But as we lie here, I'd like to think that all we've got will be ours forever. Don't you think we're forever? I can hear a voice on the wings of my dream, little girl. Melting me into love as it touches my heart. But sheltered in the distance of is all that I could love in a lifetime. Oh, don't you think we're forever? Oh, don't you think we're forever? Open your eyes to the call of the winds, little girl. The pillow of the night still beneath you. Oh, don't you think we're forever? Oh, don't you think we're forever? Don't you think we're forever?
Now, a quick update on the competition. In a nutshell, we're going to run it for another month. We didn't get any proper entries. There's been one entry from somebody who's already got the DVD and said, actually, I don't want to enter the competition, but these are my answers. And I think a lot of people were put off by the requirement that they say what bootleg or what concert the performances came from, and I thought that was a pretty tall order as well. So we're removing that requirement. All you have to do is say what the songs are, and I'm going to play the competition MP3 for you again in just a sec. But also remember, to enter the competition, all you have to do is log into stormcock.net and post your answers either as a reply to the feedback thread for this podcast, or go into the forum and post it in the podcast forum there. Either will work, we'll see it either way. So once again, here are the questions.
First track, a nice easy one.
Mm-hmm.
Next track, a little bit harder. A clue. Saddam Hussein. And finally, a very tough one.
Okay, that's it. Remember, the prize is a copy of Roy's DVD, Beyond the Door. I will put a link to just the MP3 of the competition up on the show notes for this episode as well, so that if you need to have a long, hard think about it, you can just grab that MP3 and play it as many times as you like to get the answer. Okay, quick bit of feedback. I had some positive feedback for episode 22, which had Eero Koskinen as the interviewee, I should say. And let's see. Fuzzy TNTH3 said, I didn't realise how young Eero was, and I loved his comment about giving up playing the guitar, having seen Nick playing. I certainly felt the same way for a while, but Ruben's site, sadly missing in action at the moment, that was a tab site, I think, or was it a video site? Tab, I think, gave me some hope that I have recently managed to get the verse time forgot sorted out guitar-wise, although I'm struggling to sing the lyrics at the same time. Practice, practice, as Matt Churchill advised on the Matt Churchill special podcast. Lolly said some very nice things, actually. She says, I usually take a one-hour walk in the evenings, and the latest podcast is always a looked-forward-to companion. I must surely look like an idiot walking along, smiling and laughing out loud in all of the appropriate spots. You have a soothing speaking voice, PD, and joyful laugh, and definitely pulled one over with the remix fall. While this podcast was a little more outside of the realm of Roy Harper, it was entertaining just the same, and I'd like you to know that your hard work and efforts are greatly appreciated. I'll eventually put the money where the mouth is when economic times improve a little, but in the meantime, I appreciate you letting me, and I'm sure many others, float along for free. Blessings. Well, thanks ever so much. As I replied on the forum, when I started doing the podcast, it was absolute torture listening back to my voice, because obviously I do put quite a lot of effort into the production and so on, and I've kind of got used to it now. But thank you very much. Sean says, 22 podcasts in and everyone still as fresh. She also have a knack of holding the interest and injecting the quality and anticipation we've been accustomed to. Must be a tall order every month. Great job, Paul. Great Eero interview too. I always look forward to new episodes. What can I say about the music? Loved You from Unknown Soldier. Would love to listen to the version of Roy doing both vocal parts. Yeah, I'd be pretty interested in that as well. Okay, that wraps it up for feedback. So I think we'll have the legal credits and copyright now. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license. That means you can share it with others, but you cannot change it, claim you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. If you want to send me feedback, pd@stormcock.net is the email address, or you can post feedback on the forums, or if you're brave, you can record yourself some audio feedback and send it in. Send me an MP3 attachment, or you can just call the phone in the UK, 01223 850 282. If you're not in the UK, +44 1223 850 282. Much appreciated. And this episode has run long. It seems to happen every time at the moment. I'm very sorry for those of you that try and put these on CD. Since we've run long, I'll make the most of it, and I'm going to play Acapulco Gold from Valentine, and then we'll be finishing with a special 2-minute extract of the very underrated track Melkor's Door from Driftwood, featuring Duncan Brown on rhythm guitar, Simon Taylor on lead guitar, and Paul Davison on bass. See you next month. See, that was
Acapulco Gold. Waiting for my lady. Waiting for my lady. She is over the range in the kitchen, making something strange. My lady.